Welcome to ModCast, a Civilization podcast focused on game modding, with co-hosts Thalascus,
hello,
myself, Jacob Zeanwolf Turner, Peter Maniac Steenbicke,
hi everyone,
with guest co-host Daniel J. Spatz Hanisch, and guest co-host Madjin.
Mods? Mods? Wait, I'm on ModCast?
Oh, you're in the wrong place. I thought you were the Polycast guy.
We'll kick you over there.
Oh, wait, no, you were the Refcast cast guy, too.
The Turncast guy.
Yeah. I had to collect all the casts.
Collect them all.
You're the first one ever to appear on all casts. Polycast, ModCast, Turncast, and Refcast.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
And you win.
What do I win?
A woohoo.
What do I win?
You're like
woo-hoo.
An absolute legend. You get a special mention or a place in our heart of Dan Quick. Yeah, even Dan Quick hasn't appeared on ModCast. He only did a cameo.
Oh. Poor Dan.
So, what are your historic words to all your fans across all the Civilization sites?
Yo.
Whoa.
Revolutionary.
I have
fans? We're going to frame that in. Of course, you even have your own YouTube channel.
Yeah, there's a couple of views on the YouTube channel.
Yeah, even I listened to you once. I'm trying to grab some strategy for my PBEMs.
Well, that's kind of what it's there for.
Yeah.
Trying to help everybody with the basics.
Indeed, and on that YouTube channel, I also discovered that you play all the scenarios that Firaxis has released in the DLC. That's why we have invited you. The scenarios included in the DLC are also a form of modding, so they deserve to be covered here, so that our listeners can decide whether they are worth buying. And what better person to invite for that purpose than you.
Oh, thanks.
We talked about covering the conquest of the New World scenario today, which is included in the Spanish Inca, the Double Civilization and Scenario Pack.
Yes, it is. Though I definitely agree with you, especially for modders, the scenarios that are built in through the DLC are a great way to see how they've created scenarios. Obviously not all are equal in how deep they've gone with the scenarios, but even if you just want to find out how to create a scenario, just flipping through the files and how they've made the mod, because it is a mod in all effect, finding out how they did it is a great way to form the basis of creating your own scenario mod.
Out of the Civ 5 scenarios so far, how would you which ones would you consider most to look at in terms of modding?
Very likely the Korean scenario or the Wonders of the Ancient World scenario for depth, especially for the Wonders of the Ancient World scenario. They completely changed how you get wonders, and they built in a brand new system for like tracking culture or science or kills towards being able to open those wonders. So that there's a completely different setup in that respect. With Korea, you have the different factions, and they've turned off things like science, turned off some other areas, as well as set each of them up with a slightly different way of working, which is always good.
Relatively Paradise. New capability added to the game, I believe, in the June patch.
Yeah.
Turning off parts of the game, you mean?
Yes, completely disabling science and such.
Yeah, I think that came out with the 1066 Year of the Viking Destiny, so the Denmark DLC. I think that was the first one that completely turned things off. Paradise Found is also very different in the way that culture works, because it's tracking towards your culture for the win, for the number of policies. So they've actually changed victory conditions on that one.
So what are the main characteristics of the Incan New World scenario?
For one, their victory condition is based on getting to a certain amount of victory points, rather than domination or culture or science or anything else. From a modding perspective, it's knowing how to change the victory conditions and turn off the other ones so that you don't have to worry about accidentally getting one of the other ones. Otherwise, it is a race towards 1,000 victory points. And there are certain ways to get bonus victory points. Reaching China, which is just a little patch of culture border over on the far west side of the map. If you get there with caravels, the first three caravels that get there gain you some excess victory points. And then that's it. As well as for the native civs, so the Incans, the Iroquois and the Aztecs, you have access to building two wonders, Machu Picchu and Chichen Itza. And again, it is limited to just those three civilizations. So the three European civs, Spain, England, and France, cannot build them. So that's also something to look at from a modding perspective, is limitations on who can do what. As well, they've changed each of the leaders for the most part. Like France gained the Greek unique ability and lost out on both its unique units. Though the musketeer is in the game, it's not unique to France. And England lost its ship of the line and longbow. And as well, Isabella's conquistador and Tercio are used by everybody. And they've also modified the tech tree. So it's a slightly modified version of the tech tree where they've moved some things around. Horses only show at horseback riding. There is no long swords, which does cause a little problem if you're a native civ building swordsman. There's no way to upgrade them to a later unit, which is a bit of a pain. Up until the most recent patch, you were able to upgrade pikemen to tercios, which was a nice push for the European civs. But they've since changed that.
Oh, that was a change mentioned in the patch, in the latest patch?
No, actually, the latest patch was very cryptic on the changes for this particular scenario. It just said that they were doing balance changes, and that was it.
Yeah, no, I haven't really noticed any difference. I played it before and after the latest patch once, but didn't notice anything.
Yeah, there's it's very hidden, some of the things that they've balanced out. Obviously, the scenario, actually, one of the drawbacks to the scenario, and definitely if you're going to create your own mod scenario, one of the things you're going to have to watch out for is that all of the balance changes or patch changes that Firaxis has done to the main game have filtered directly into the New World scenario. So the Iroquois don't need iron anymore, and for their unique units, all of the balance changes to units have filtered in. So that's can be very problematic if they made a change to a particular building or something along that line that is very useful in the main game, but in this scenario no longer is of much use.
Yeah, something that comes to mind is the rationalism opener. I believe I don't even remember what it gave before the last patch.
Golden Age.
A Golden Age, indeed. But now it just increases value of research agreements. But those have been turned off in the Conquest of the New World scenario. So yeah, in that sense, patch changes can be problematic.
Oh yeah, definitely. On that particular opener though, I'm wondering if they watched one of my videos, because I used to use the rationalism opener as one of the European civs, mostly as French because they start with more cash or more gold than the rest of the civs. But I used to use rationalism to ensure that I took scientific revolution as my fourth policy, just as I settled a city in the New World. And then with that, I would get up to warships and be able to build my frigates and then go take on the two European powers and take their capitals. And for the longest time before that patch, when you took a capital, you gained three treasure units. And that's another thing the scenario does, is it adds a new unique unit, which is a treasure unit that gives you 50 victory points if you bring it back to your capital. Now, you also get it through Cerro de Pozzi and El Dorado, or Skill Dorado, as I like to call it. But taking down a capital automatically gave you three of those. And anytime you raised a different city, you randomly got treasure units if you were raising it. So one of my favorite plays as the French was just to take rationalism, go get some frigates, and then piracy, which again is another modded change to the game, where you can't attack another European civ until you have piracy. You would get that and then promptly just use a bunch of frigates to take out the English and Spanish capitals, gain 50 points per treasure unit, so that's 300 points towards your goal, and just quickly bring them back to my capital and basically win, as long as I can get a couple of the caravels to China before the other two AI. So that was a fun little thing, but they've changed it so that you cannot gain treasury units out of the European capitals if you're Europe. Now, I don't know if you can gain them if you're one of the native
Because it's rather close. I mean, close by. It's not like the difficulty of getting it across the Atlantic.
Literally right next to each other. Now, they've also blocked off terrain in the European territory. So there's a vast grassland area between France and England. And even on England, where Scotland and Ireland are, you can't move units there. So again, that's another point of mod where you can create locations with city borders or city culture borders effectively to block off terrain. So if you absolutely don't want players to have the ability to go into a certain area just because it would break your scenario, then you can do that.
Yeah, so basically, that way to victory was too easy. But I don't know, I played once as a Spanish and once as the Inca, but I felt that even playing as a Spanish, even not using your trick to conquer the European capitals, I still felt the game was rather easy. Basically, I attacked the Iroquois, raised one of their cities, but it was too small, so I didn't gain any treasury. Then I conquered another Iroquois city. They offered me another city in a peace treaty, raised both of those cities. That alone was already enough to gain enough victory points to win the game.
Oh yeah.
My question to you was, don't you feel that playing with Europeans, that the scenario isn't too easy, no matter what you do?
Well, it depends. I mean, things have changed. So I think the European civs are a little bit harder. You get scurvy, which is another promotion that they built for the scenario. And what scurvy does is basically give you a 66% chance, I believe. Yeah, 65% chance to take 1 point of damage if you end your turn outside of friendly territory. So that could be a city state or your own culture borders. So they use scurvy as a way to prevent a quick race effectively straight to China, and as well prevent you from just having a very large fleet as the Europeans and just wipe out the native civs just with a fleet alone. Of course, you can build the navigation school if you get into navigation, but it is a little bug. It says it removes scurvy from all naval units built by the Empire, but it only counts for units that you build after you build the navigation school. So if you go for a quick fleet and then build the navigation school, none of those ships will have the scurvy promotion removed, which is a little weird.
Otherwise, it would be too easy to reach China if a ship already half the way suddenly lost its scurvy. They are delaying the point that you can reach China.
They could do it like embarkation, where the scurvy is lost when you enter cultural borders. All this is a good example of why balance testing is important, even for scenarios. I'm sure they didn't put as much effort into balancing the scenarios because they figured people would probably play them a few times and then move back onto other things.
Yeah, you mentioned embarkation. That's another thing that kind of counteracts the argument that scurvy makes conquest of the natives easier. If I recall correctly, scurvy does not affect embarked land units.
Yep, no, they don't. So yes, you can quickly build a military and get across. Of course, the native civs start with 2,000 gold each. And unfortunately, the European civs start in the Renaissance. On the modified tech tree, they have astronomy, so they can build their caravels. And then there's a navigation side of things where you can get the seaport and the navigation school and then move on to banks, privateers, and warships. As well, from chivalry and astronomy, you can get to imperialism, which is a new technology, which lets you have the conquistador, which is kind of funny because there is chivalry in the game, but chivalry lets you build knights, whereas if you get imperialism, you can build the conquistador. And then after that, you go to professional soldiers with the tertio or religious orders with the monastery. And even the monastery as a building has been changed. It actually acts closer to tradition opener than it does to a real monastery, where culture costs of acquiring new tiles are reduced by 75%. As well, the native civs get to start with calendar and trapping, so they can improve other luxury items very quickly, whereas the European civs do not have that. They have to actually research those texts. Whereas the native civs, when they start, they're actually starting back in the classical and medieval era. So you have to research stuff like civil service, currency, and other things, like metal casting. And so there's a slightly wider medieval era tech, area that you have to get through, as the native civs, but you can catch up fairly quickly. And again, one of these things about patch changes affecting the modded scenario, when cities got put up to three unhappiness per city and luxuries got dropped down to four happiness per luxury, that actually causes a fair bit of trouble in this scenario, because the European civs start with gems and wine in their capitals, but since they don't have those two technologies, they don't get the happiness out of it. But even still, that's only going to add a total of eight happiness rather than 10, and you're chewing up more happiness per city by planting new cities. And every city that you plant is going to start at three population with a number of buildings. So right there, you're adding six unhappiness per city that you drop.
In one of your videos, you recommended to buy settlers if you were a native civ with that 2,000 gold. But indeed, when I was playing the Inca, I found that even with my starting settlers alone, I already used all my positive happiness. So basically, I was sitting on a pile of gold, which I couldn't do all that much useful stuff with.
Oh yeah, that has very much affected the Inca, native civs, because while the European civs start with one city and a very tall capital, they start with 10 population, but they have heroic epic, the national college, the national epic, and a long list of buildings already in their city. They can punch out very high-powered units very quickly. Of course, the English and the Spanish start with only, I think, 200 gold. It's a very low amount. Only the French get 1,000. The native civs get 2,000 each. So if you choose to do a very big expansion with the native civs to try and keep the European powers off your borders or off your continental area and settle a large number of cities right away, you're going to quickly go into some severe negative happiness. And that is a little dangerous. So my one of the suggested openings I had was liberty, citizenship, and collective rule to be able to get another free settler and be able to keep spamming those settlers. It doesn't quite work that way anymore. And even when the scenario came out, liberty was not giving you a free settler or a free worker, let alone the representation helping with your culture costs. And the Golden Age, like liberty itself was not the same. And even still, at one point, you were able to get that great person out of meritocracy, which effectively gave you Chichenista on turn one. So all of that's changed. This is one of those things about when you're creating a mod, especially a modded scenario, you really have to ensure that you lock down anything you expect to be changed or expect not to be changed. Like with the Polynesian scenario, they were slightly smarter in that respect, where they actually limited you to three policies or policy branches, but every one of them was adjusted and changed so that any changes to the main game won't affect those policies in the scenario. And you can start seeing that with the later scenarios, but the New World scenario is very much very much modified constantly when the main game changes, which can be a bit of a problem.
It does also give a good example of, generally, since it's difficult to lock down everything in the game, it shows the importance of maintenance and making sure that mods or scenarios are easy to maintain over time as things change behind the scenes, which, unless if you have any final thoughts, leads into our second topic.
Actually, I did have one bigger question on the, going beyond just the Spanish one that we were talking about for the most part here, the DLC as a whole, have you noticed any kind of a progression from them? I heard a lot of people claim that they weren't so much, this is something fun you can do, as a, here, would you test this specific mechanic for us type of feel in some of the early ones. Do these later ones feel more story developed fun, or are they still pretty focused?
Yeah, I'm not sure that the mechanics changes were in the previous one, in the early ones, especially like Rise of the Mongols scenario. It's really all about a domination game, and so there really wasn't any change per se. Conquest of the New World, I do like the fact that they used the fractal map type, because then the map will always be different on the New World side of things. So it's a fun one that you can keep playing over and over, and they haven't really changed too many of the mechanics. Now, Paradise Found, 1066 Year of the Viking Destiny, Samurai Invasion of Korea, and the Wonders of the Ancient World scenario, they've definitely been changing mechanics. Especially on that Wonders of the Ancient World scenario. It was a very big mechanics change. So in that respect, I've noticed, especially in the patch notes, just what modders can do, without the DLL files, has changed with each of these mods. It does look like because they've created this mod and wanted to do something with this scenario, that they couldn't do before, they've opened up more. To the modding community. And that seems to be a nice progression. But each of them are fun in their own way. Though most of them are on quick speed, so they're fairly quick to finish, because they all have a limited number of turns, except for the Wonders of the Ancient World scenario, where you just have to end up winning by the wonders, so you're not on a turn timer necessarily. I mean, there are there, but they're all going to disappear very quickly. I guess the answer is a little yes and no on the mechanics side of things. I seriously doubt they're going to implement a wonder acquisition strategy like they have in the Wonder of Ancient Worlds scenario. I could see the game would be completely changed by having you do something before you can build that wonder. Everything in the base game would become it'd be very, very different, and the AI would probably have far more advantages if they did that, but it doesn't make as much sense, especially in the continuation of key mechanics from Civ 4 and Civ 3 and the whole line. Right.
I'd also like to ask one last question. This is Modcast, so we can discuss how you would like to improve stuff. As you may have noticed, I like the scenario when playing as a native Civ, but I think it's too easy as a European Civ. I was thinking as a possible solution that instead of gathering victory points, the mission is to gather a certain amount of gold. In my opinion, that would have two advantages. One, the AI doesn't seem to know that the goal is to get victory points. Besides going for China, they don't really seem to aim for it. On the other hand, the AI is very good at hoarding lots of gold. Perhaps better stated, they are very bad at using their gold. So I believe with that victory condition, the Europeans would be a bigger challenge for you. The second reason is also, I felt that when playing as the Spanish, that it wasn't worthwhile at all to settle the New World, except one city near El Dorado and Potosi silver mines for the treasury. So if the goal would be to gather hoard lots of gold, then it would actually become profitable to found new cities and build lots of trading posts around them, because in a New World scenario, I think colonization should be one of the big elements.
Well, I think it already is. The vast majority of your victory points is going to come from number of cities, land, population.
I don't know. I think that's true for the natives, but for the Europeans, like I said, I just won with Spanish by conquering one city and then getting another from a peace treaty and raising them both.
There is some balance in there. It's a little hard to want to go to a gold-based victory condition, specifically because the AI has so many cheats. Like, their maintenance costs are lower, their gold spending is lower, Their unit costs are lower, and everything else. So you can quickly see civs, even in this scenario, rise to quite a high gold base. Now, the other problem to that is a good human player will build up a military, go beat down on another civ, and have a peace treaty where that civ hands over all their gold. So now you still have them as mini banks, and you can just as easily abuse the system to pick up all that gold.
That is part of a big problem in vanilla right now, and in my own modding experiences, the AI is willing, it just doesn't seem to value peace treaties well. Sometimes it asks too much, that's an unreasonable amount, or sometimes it gives away too much. Something in there is a little bit off.
Oh, well, yeah.
One solution you could use for this scenario would just be give the European civilizations one victory point per turn per luxury resource that they're getting from the New World colonies, or something like that, where you can't just hoard it, you can't trade for huge amounts in a peace treaty. So it would encourage you to settle, but it wouldn't really encourage you to do any kind of artificial behavior for hoarding. Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a good idea.
I mean, there are multiple ways to play the game when it comes to for the scenario. I mean, you can do that domination quest, and I've done it where, yeah, the peace treaty has given me the win, because I was playing as the Iroquois, and I made the Aztecs give me a peace treaty, which gave a bunch of cities, and that instantly made me win, even though one of the other AIs, one of the European AIs, were getting close to winning, because I picked up all their land and population. But even as Europeans, a settling pattern going for mass settling across the islands, or a section of a continent that the native civs haven't gotten to, is still very plausible as an option. Though, of course, Cerro de Pazzi and El Dorado are very important in this scenario. Being able to get a hold of those for the random treasure units is always a good thing.
Something that's very useful for mods is something that's been gaining prominence in software development recently, which is called agile development. And the basic principle is that instead of doing all of your planning at once and then do all of the work and then do all the testing in these big, huge phases, you do a little bit at a time. And so you do it in small portions and you do it in cycles, so that, in other words, the basic cycle is you figure out what you're going to do, you do planning, and then the second step is you implement it, you mod whatever it is you want to work on, and then after you've implemented it, you test it, figure out, make sure that it's working properly, and then you review what you've just done. And that usually, for modding Civ 5, involves getting feedback from form goers. And then you repeat that cycle of plan, do, test, and review for each new change you add. The changes might be small, they might be big, but in general, you want to try and have this cycle going so that you're gradually building up the mod bit by bit and testing each part instead of just throwing it all in there and doing huge amounts of planning without actually having anything done yet. Like, for example, I started out with just one very basic change. It was just +1 production to mines and lumber mills with engineering. And then over the course of a year, that grew into a much larger project. So you just want to get something simple out the door, some sort of proof of concept. This is something I was recommending to a few people who were putting together a mod recently, is it's good to have long-term planning and to have goals and to aim towards those goals while you're working on your mod. But if you're just getting started, especially if you're still on your own, you want to try and get something basic, something simple out the door right away, and then get that tested, make sure it's working properly, get some feedback from people, and then plan your next step. What do you want to add next? And use your goals to base off of that. And then use your plan for the next step to implement it, focus on just what you want to get done next, and then get that tested, get more feedback, and continually build on yourself so that your mod can gain traction over time. one good reason for this
start
is
small and
go on ahead.
I say you start small, code one bit, move on to the next. And the biggest problem I've seen on, especially on the message boards, is people come up with these great designs about things that just aren't practical yet, either because we don't have the DLL or because we're not really familiar with the Lua functions that might make them accessible. And you need to learn what's possible and adjust your design to that on some level. And keep the old notes about what you had originally intended in case things unlock in the future. But, you know, if the first pass that you're doing compromises in 20 different ways, but it's still playable, then that's a good starting point and you can move on to the next step.
And another part of modding is that we're essentially all inventors. We're coming up with an idea, we're saying, hey, we think this is a great idea, but you don't actually know if other people are going to think the same way. You might think that this is the best possible thing that could be added to the game, but it's not necessarily what the general public is going to feel like. So something I learned from experience in the past is I put all this work into a project a few years ago, you know, got all this stuff out, and then there was absolutely no interest in it. It was just like, you know, no response. And so I felt to myself, why did I put all this work into this if no one's ever going to play it? And I can't even get anyone to play it, so I can't even really, you know, improve it any if I can't get a game started. So it's important to get something small out there first.
Yeah, absolutely. Feedback is a very good loop because, I mean, basically, as has been said, you might do something and somebody else has been thinking very similar lines. And then once you get it out there, you find out that, oh, maybe you didn't take into consideration something very critical to that piece. And if that piece is the core of your mod, well, it might cause the whole mod to go down if you wait before releasing something.
There's the issue of compatibility. You come out with a balance mod, and you're trying to basically compete with Falasca's balance of mods, and you're trying to say, you know, try use my mod, but if all these people already have something that does a similar thing, it works, they like it better, they're not going to switch over very often. So, you know, you kind of have to do something new in a lot of ways. Pick some intellectual property like Alpha Centauri that they like using, or like my next project that I'm working on is a mythology-based thing. People like that. People like reading about that. And as long as there's not a current mod out there that does that, there'll be some interest.
But, competition is a good thing. Just because there's one mod that tries to balance something doesn't mean that somebody else doesn't have a better way to balance. Because again, we all have our different perspectives on what balance means.
True, but back in Civ 4, I was working on a mod, and it was based on Alpha Centauri, and I was coming up with a tech tree and doing all kinds of neat things there, and it was coming along nicely. Then somebody came out with this mod called Planetfall or something like that that basically did a lot of the same stuff.
Might have heard of that.
Yeah. At which point I was like, well, you know, I could finish it up, but he's already done more and better than I have currently. So I just kind of worked on it a little as an intellectual exercise, but kind of mothballed it. And then when Civ 5 rolled out, I just pulled out my notes from Civ 4, updated them a little bit to the new mechanisms, and that was the starting point for the Alpha Centauri mod.
Exactly.
Well, also, don't be afraid, though, if someone else putting out something the same as you, especially if you haven't actually seen it yet, to go ahead and keep doing your work. One thing that I had worked on back in Civ 4 with my Fall from Heaven mod that I was with was we built a generals system where you could link units to one another, and they could give one another bonuses and all that kind of stuff. And I thought it was awesome and innovative, and no one would ever have done anything like it. And when we finally announced to the public that this is what we were doing, and we were being sort of vague about it, as people got a sense of what was happening, then one of them was like, oh, so it's exactly like what Heroes of the Three Kingdoms does. I was like, what? Wait, huh? I've never looked at this mod. And so I went over and looked at it, and as far as the title of what they were doing was, it sounded like it was exactly what I did. But it wasn't until they finally released what they were working on, and I released what I did, that we realized, even though they were described the same way, they were massively different systems. Because mine was like, the units integrated with each other directly. They could give each other boosts and stuff. And theirs was more of, as far as I could tell, like basically the XML code stored values would change for these units over time. Or something. It was, you know, those units would evolve and they were their own system in the game. So the approaches were completely different. The other types of things you could do with the code we generated were vastly different.
Yeah, I'm not trying to tell people don't make mods because I got there first. But although, you know, please hold off making your own mythology mods if I can find. But it's
or help
just,
each other.
If you're trying to if you're trying to get new testers to come in and look at your mod, you need a hook of some kind. It's a basic advertising thing. You need a catchy name. You need to base it on some property they already like. You gotta, you know, specifically say, we're adding this new game system. It helps. That kind of stuff helps. Now, there's going to be a good number of people who will just read through every thread they can find, download every mod that sounds even remotely interesting. And so you can get, you'll always be able to get some of those people. But, you know, the more committed people are to one mod, the less they tend to look around in a lot of ways. I mean, I still have to remind myself periodically, you know, look at some of the other popular mods out there, try them out a little bit, because you'll learn stuff by playing their mods and get new ideas for your own work.
But you definitely bring up two key points in there. One, if you have an idea that's very similar to somebody else's, it may be better if you pool your efforts rather than do competition, especially if they're not out. And two, advertise. The most critical component that most people who develop things completely forget about.
If you can build the
most awesome system, and if you don't tell anybody about it, it won't go anywhere.
I only started putting my mod, the link to it, in my SIG like a month ago, even though I had the mod out for a year. And so every time I started posting random answers to questions in the forums, suddenly people would see that and pop over to my mod and try it out. And, you know, it hadn't even occurred to me that that was really what I needed to be doing to get people to come look at the stuff.
Yeah. On the note of advertising, if you would like to be a guest on Modcast.
Okay, so there's four really important steps in the Agile development process. The first part is coming up with ideas, designing, and planning. The second step is to do the ideas. The third step is to test how they worked out. And the fourth step is to get feedback and analyze. So we've talked about the first step in the process, which is how to find, come up with, and plan ideas. The second step is doing the ideas that you find. And something really important here is prioritizing, because like was discussed earlier, some things are much, much easier to do technically with the tools available to modders than other things. There might be some idea that, you know, will have this big impact on the game and turns out to only require a few simple changes in the files. And then there might be another idea that might take days and days of work to get done. So one important thing to do is once you have a to-do list of sorts of things you want in your mod, start prioritizing those ideas. So figure out, okay, this one looks like it might be difficult, but it's really good, so I might do it a little bit earlier than this other hard thing that won't have much effect. And this sort of plays into something called the 80-20 rule, where 80% of what you do for any given project will generally be easier than the last 20%. And so you want to get all the 80% of the main stuff done, get most of it completed and out of the way, and then move on to other things that will take more effort and more time with less gain.
If your mod has a series of quick wins and you're just getting it up, then take the quick wins and get that out of there. I can definitely agree on that. I always go back to the lazy engineering plan, which is always attack the hard problem first. Quick wins are quick wins, and sometimes those are really good. But if you tackle all the easy stuff and then find out that the hard thing actually in the end affects those easy things and makes you go back to change them, then you're going to have to spend more time than you would have otherwise going back and making all those changes versus taking on that hard problem, at least to understand it, if maybe not code it, but at least to understand it and know what it will do, and even get that prototype of the hard problem fixed. and then go off to do some of those easy pieces. So prioritization is important to balance out the quick wins to get you started versus actually tackling that hard piece. Because you will have to do it, and if you leave it for last, you're going to basically leave yourself with a very, very long process of refixing everything that you chose not to look at the beginning.
Yeah, and sometimes the hard features are the ones which make your mod unique and draw people to it.
Right. That's why it's important in your priorities to both consider how hard it is to do and how much impact it will have. A good example is one of the first things I did when starting to modify the Civilization V user interface is I set up the building tooltips so that they read their data directly from the game files. That way there's no need to manually update the tooltips every single time any change is made, and it reduces the chance of errors in the tooltips. And this way it sped up all the small building changes I wanted to make later because I could skip the process of doing the tooltip entirely. It had already been done through a more difficult method, but early on.
It'll also depend on what your previous experience. If you've been a kind of guy who programs in 20 different languages and can pick up a new one easily, then getting into the habit of coding up the Lua logic is not that difficult. And it's very, very powerful in that you can do practically anything. It's just a question of whether you can teach the AI to do it as well as you do. But if you haven't programmed a lot before, if you're not really comfortable with those kinds of languages yet, then there's a learning curve. There's a lot of stuff that at first, even if it might actually be easy to do, you're not ready to do it yet. So the XML changes are a good starting point. And because you know you're not going to have to mess around with trying to teach the AI to do anything with it. It will already do it more or less.
I would consider in that respect, the hard problem would be understanding the tools, i.e. Lua or XML, rather than actually trying to just change a few values. Understanding it first, especially if you've never programmed before, would probably be the better start, rather than just a few quick minor changes.
Well, like you described how in the scenario, the change from 2 based on happiness to 3 and 5 based happiness for luxury to 4 had a massive impact. You can still do really substantial stuff with just the XML. In my own mod, I think I spent the first 3 months changing things without touching the Lua at all. And only once, because in my mod, I actually changed the base on happiness to 4. So it was a lot of the same kind of issues.
Another thing to be said in favor of not doing all the easy stuff early is stress management and background processing. Sometimes with the really, really hard things, if you're working on just that one thing forever, you will want to tear your hair out. So swapping over to, hey, I can belt this out simple, lets you get a win in your pocket and be kind of happy with it. And then also the background processing idea, if you get completely and totally stuck and you have no idea what to do next, step away from it for a couple weeks or something. And you can start to feel the gears turning as you look at other stuff and you might find an answer to it.
Yeah, if you start stressing out because of your mod, it's no longer a game, it's a job again.
Well, yeah.
It's very true. Something that would be really helpful to read in this regard is in the Civilization Fanatics forums, under the Creation and Customization forum and the Modding Tutorials and Reference subforum, I made a post there back in March, which has been bumped a few times, about the thread is titled Creativity and Decision-Making, and this talks about some of the science behind doing creative things like modding and also how to make good decisions. And one of the main things is that you do your creative tasks when your mind is refreshed, when it's not bogged down with lots of details. So that's the reason why if you've ever done any art or music or modding or anything else, oftentimes you'll find that after taking a break, when you come back to the task, you'll do much better than if you just sat there and just tried to, you know, bowl your way through the problem. And it depends on the task and it depends on the person, but overall, that can be very helpful to alternate between difficult tasks. If it starts to frustrate you, move on to something else, maybe even something completely different, like going from doing a programming task to maybe creating an icon, because those use completely different areas of the brain, so it lets you rest a while you're working on a different task.
Well, and that's why I started this mythology mod, even though I'm not quite done with my Alpha Centauri mod, because I was getting to the point where all that was really left was the tedious unit model creation, things like that, where I might like the results, but it's not really that much fun to actually do. So working on multiple things at once, multiple different parts of it, is a good stress reliever.
Definitely. So now we've covered finding and planning ideas, step one. We've covered step two, which is how to prioritize and do the ideas. And then step three is how to properly test to make sure that what you've done is working correctly. One great way to do this is to create a sort of test map. You can go into the world editor and create a small map with a few players placed in a few city-states and resources and such, in such a way so that you can start up this scenario map and test out anything you might need to do. And so you can give yourself, 10,000 gold and, whatever technologies you might need to test out, whatever policies, and you can alter that test map to experiment with whatever it is that you're changing or modding in the game.
So this is one of those things where it helps to have a large team, because I used to be a software developer at one point, and it was really useful to have one member of the team who kept track of everything that was going on, but it was also useful to have at least one guy who was the designated bull in the china shop, who would go through and just get the first pass done of whatever massive change you needed to do. But, as long as not everybody's doing that, you can think on that as just having a good number of testers who are committed to kind of testing the same things each time.
Say, because Civ 5's not coming with the test architecture and you're working more on the XML and Lua, you can use, there are automated testing architectures out there for this type of code. There's pretty much something, XUnit, it's out there. So I would approach it as a system that has absolutely no testing and you don't trust any of it. So add some tests around what you build, make sure what you built and what it interacts with works as you expect, and then just slowly build up a test case. That way, if you move off to another mod that's supposed to interact with the old one, you can again double check to make sure that your old mod works as expected while you make changes to the new one. And it's just a slow progression towards building up a test framework. It's more to make sure that you know for certain that your code changes are still doing what you expected, and you don't have to effectively waste a lot of time going back and doing testing via people who may or may not see things or may or may not be able to see the stuff under the hood, especially for situations where it's like little calculations under the hood that may give the same answer in the UI, but could be completely different calculations and could break in mysterious ways and then blow up. So it's better to have the safety and knowledge and basically take the lazy approach. Do it once, make sure it's right, and then you don't have to go back to it again.
Right.
The downside with this, of course, is we're limited in a lot of ways by the full experience of the game. It may appear that a system is working fine, but when you try and play a full game using it, you start noticing that it's screwed up your gold balance or your research rates or something like that just through very indirect means. It's very hard to have a change that's completely self-contained.
I was
going to agree with that. Obviously there's other factors involved to deal with, but overall it's a safer way to move forward. But I wouldn't suggest that for small mods. It'd be more the larger mods would take approach, but absolutely having your code base safe. And even as Jacob had mentioned earlier, where variables are getting different names, but you'll have the same, it's all trying to do the same thing. Having a nice little design document that everybody can see saying, this is this. Even in Agile, writing it down is still very, very important.
It is one of the advantages of being a one-person modding team is that, you know, you have all the documents in front of you and you remember everything that you've done. But I've had quite a few times where someone reports a bug that was I had completely had a blind spot to because, you know, I would play a certain way and I'd never trigger certain things. You know, I would never build nukes and so hadn't noticed that we were completely unbalancing the game. So being the one-man team has advantages and disadvantages. And,
yeah. Anyway. So there's four parts to the life cycle. You plan it, you do it, you test it, and then you review. And the review part for mods and Civilization is getting feedback from people who play your mod and figuring out how to use that effectively in your development process. And in particular, this is one thing that's really important in something that's a hobby like this, or in also the professional development world, is getting feedback from your audience. And anyone want to add some thoughts to this?
Perhaps in order to get the most feedback possible, perhaps it's a good idea never to release a stable version. That way your users are forced to beta test for you. I don't know. What do you guys think?
If you have hundreds of people playing your mod, you'll be lucky to get half a dozen people that regularly come in with substantial feedback. You'll get a few people saying, you know, I love the mod, I love what you're doing here, and give a small suggestion or something like that. But in terms of tangible, useful feedback, you know, you're not going to get a huge amount. There's no substitute for playing it yourself and looking at it. But
yeah.
the thing to remember is you know more than they do. There's you're going to have people that are confused. In my mod at one point, I added a new national wonder, and somebody was bragging about how easy it was for them to always beat the other civilizations to this new wonder that I had added. And they had never found out that it was a national wonder because there was nothing obvious saying that. But, you know, you're going to know more about the intricacies of this than anyone else. So a lot of the feedback you're going to get will be things that isn't going to be the most useful stuff.
And even feedback like that, if someone says, you know, well, I'm always able to get to this wonder first, there might be some way to, you know, make it more clear that this is a wonder, this is a national wonder. Perhaps there's something that can be done to enhance that.
I added in the user interface in the little help tool box to where it'll now say in red, national wonder, one per empire, automatically. So.
Exactly.
But even on those two lines, I would say first, don't release something that's unstable, especially if it's new. Just because along this line that you might not get very much feedback, you are far more likely to get people who try to pick it up because they might think it's a cool idea, find out it's unstable, and then delete it and never talk to you about it.
Yeah.
So you're actually reducing the number of people who might actually continue to use it. The other side to it, I would suggest, though, is because there is such a wide modding community, especially at the Civ Fanatics forums, even just generating getting a number of modders together to say, hey, let's co-test each other's mods. Just at least so you can have a group of people, and of course, as the community grows, it can get very large. Getting people who are willing to check out your mod if you check out their mod for testing purposes and feedback purposes. And that can be a very simple way to make sure that the more technical aspects of things that you're trying to do are actually looked at versus just people who are using it but might not know that you made this core change, or maybe don't even understand how you've done that change and wouldn't be able to tell you that, oh yeah, by the way, there is this little thing if you hit this situation.
Very true. I have had some modders give feedback on my own mod, and it is absolutely invaluable because they can go look into the code and say, okay, this is where it's going wrong. So it's like if they encounter some bug, I've had a few people in the bug reports forum who will say, this is exactly where the bug is. This is what's going wrong. And like, wow, that is like the best bug report ever.
Yeah.
Yep.
The more knowledgeable they are about what you're doing, the better the feedback is going to be. And thankfully, a lot of the modders in Civ 5 do seem to be playing each other's mods fairly often.
Yeah.
This is something you really get good with. This is something you get great if you start getting modders. because they have to integrate your code into their code whenever you do a release, and they know how to do code. So document well and encourage people to play with your stuff instead of always just asking you to do it. Because as soon as someone else starts basing their work on yours, they have to review your code. And it's awesome when they come back and say, hey, you messed up my stuff by doing this, and you didn't do that right. And you go, oh, okay, I changed exactly what you told me to, and it works. Yay!
There's also situations where you might do something correctly, and it might, you know, a Lua script that you write does exactly what you want, but it works only for your mod. And you might be using variable names or resources that another mod also does, and somehow when you combine the two, even though they don't seem to interact very much, it makes that, it causes a problem. Whereas you could have written your code slightly differently to be able to have it more modular, and allow it to interact better. So again, this goes back to the quick route versus the more complete process way of writing, and that is part of that review process, especially on the modder side, is feedback. That feedback loop. You might get the review, and it might be okay, I need to make this little change here because maybe they don't understand it. But you also might get, you know, feedback into your planning stage saying, oh, I actually have to redo this piece because it's now breaking something else that I want this to work with.
Okay, a disclaimer to what I said earlier. My practice was to release one stable version, called version 15 or something, which I was sure was stable, and then release new features in the patches. So people could, yeah, only use the stable version if they wanted to, but if they wanted the neat new stuff, they needed to play the patches. So indeed, they had the option, yeah, if they wanted to beta test or not.
Yeah, if you can clearly say these versions are stable, use them if you really want to make sure that you can actually finish the game. Then, because I've had testers who are like, when I put out a new version, they'll ask me, you know, should I download this yet? I'm like, are you in the middle of a game currently? And they're like, yes. It's like, well, I stay with the old version. You know it. You're working with it. It's stable. Keep going. Finish a game. Give me good feedback that way. And then whenever you feel like it, update to the latest thing. As long as they're playing one that doesn't have a known bug in it, that's good feedback. Very is true. Better than good feedback is better than frequent feedback.
Yeah.
Also, something to recommend: if your project starts getting to be somewhat larger, or like if you've started a thread on Civ Fanatics and the thread's starting to get rather long, something to be aware of is that there are project development forms available for modders on Civ Fanatics, and you can ask one of the administrators to set up a project form for you. And that can be very helpful, because rather than having everyone following a single thread with, you know, a dozen different conversations going on, people can start different threads for different topics. And that's underutilized in Civ 5. It's used a lot in Civ 4, but I haven't seen many projects yet that move over there in Civ 5, and I'd highly recommend it for anyone whose mod is starting to, their thread is getting, you know, more than 3 or 4 pages and lots of posts going on.
My suggestion would be, if you have 1,000 posts or something in your threads, then you know you're going to stay.
Yeah. if you have that many people looking at it, then
My thread has like 1,400, but at least half of them are me. But even with that, I mean, it was okay when I was only doing a one very focused thing, but I've started expanding more. So now there's a good 5 conversations going on at once. A project forum is much, much better for something like that.
Yeah. And something to be aware of is the administrators are, I don't want to speak too much for their policies, but what DJ said when I was talking to him earlier is that if it looks like that your mod is, you know, has a reasonable chance of continuing on, you don't have to be one of the biggest projects out there to get your own forum. Just so long as it looks like that, you know, you're dedicated, you have a, you know, decent number of people following along, and your thread's getting somewhat long, then ask. It can't hurt to ask. Even if, you know, yeah.
Yeah, TJ is a nice guy. It's a nice guy.
Yeah,
another Go ahead, Matt. You've been trying for a while.
I was just saying another thing. I mean, especially with the forum moderators and that. I mean, they're all nice people mostly, and the admins might be overstressed every once in a while. So sometimes there might be a delay don't take the delay to be an answer of no. Just take the delay for exactly what it is. Sometimes the admins are way too busy on other things.
Not to mention the fact that they're volunteers who aren't getting paid, so they have other things in their life that are going on and sometimes get distracted by work, family, friends, school, whatever might be going on. So, you know, just be persistent. If you haven't gotten a reply yet, back yet, I mean, you know, be reasonable about it, of course. But yeah, and also don't be afraid to ask the moderators or admins for help if either in your own thread or if you get your own form or whatever. I mean, they're very willing to work. They're very supportive of the community.
So a final thing to note on this is if you are working privately with a team and you're doing it through CFC, private messages, you can only send them out to up to 5 people. So it can become really cumbersome talking in private messages if your team gets bigger than that. And it's not that fun talking in them even with smaller teams. You can request private forums that only a certain amount of people can see. And you can also make groups that are locked and they get their own little discussion area. So those are two other options you can look at. You can build a group. Remember, right, you can do that without it involving the admins at all. And you can leave it locked to invite only, so no one else can see what you're talking about, and you can make all your big highfalutin plans for your mod. And if you get big enough that you want thread control, you can ask to have a private forum generated for you. So yeah, should we start doing some wrap-up stuff then?
Yep.
Anyone have anything else major to add? Nope.
No, not really.
Nope.
Okay.
Alright then, So yeah, this has been episode number 45 of Modcast, and once again, we were joined with our guest co-host, Mad Jin.
Hey, bye everybody.
As well as Daniel J. Spatz Hainish.
Thanks for having me.
And our regular co-hosts, Peter Maniac Steenbeck.
See you next time.
Velasquez.
A Wiedersehen.
And myself, Jacob Zian Wolf Turner. I bid you adieu.
Thanks for coming, everyone.
Whoa.
Hey, no, thanks for having us.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44121-288-7659. That's 44121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at thepolycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com. For more information on Modcast, our sibling shows, Polycast, Revcast, and Turncast, or about Polycast in general, log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. Civilization IV, Warlords Beyond the Sword, sound clips are copyright Take-Two Interactive.